This is Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide. Today on the show, Stephanie McMillan of MinimumSecurity.net, music by The Static Age and Filthy Politicians, and a talk by Dalia Wasvi. This is Rage, building a community of resistance one podcast at a time. Welcome to Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide, coming to you from occupied Missisquoi-Wiskagon. I am your host, Seymour Life. And a special hello to all those organizing to stop the insanity of the dominant culture. Today on the show, Stephanie McMillan. Stephanie is an award-winning cartoonist, author, and organizer. She's best known for her political cartoons, Minimum Security and Code Green. She is co-author and illustrator of As the World Burns, 50 Ways to Stay in Denial, and an illustrator of Mischief in the Forest. I started by asking her if she feels that her work is having an effect.
Well, that is a really good question, and it's the one I ask myself every day. Is what I'm doing the best thing that I could be doing? Is it making any difference whatsoever? I guess we won't really know that until we win. Whatever we're doing now, so far we're still in a very weak position and we're losing and the world is being killed and people are being exploited. So far, nothing's worked to change that. But on the other hand, when assuming that we overcome this situation, it'll be a combination of everything that we did to get it there. And I have to believe that my work will make some contribution to that. I think it was Lenin who said that there's no political action, even just a conversation, that is ever wasted, that they have ripple effects and we don't know what those end up being, but we put our effort and energy into that end, into the goal, then all we can do is believe that in some way it will contribute to winning. And I guess since I think of it as winning or losing rather than having a good effect or a bad effect, then it can't be known until the end, you know?
Right.
I don't think that we could have good effects while still without total victory, because then the earth will still be being killed. It'll just be a little bit slower or a little bit less horrendously. But we actually have to overcome, you know, make a rupture with this situation and actually transform it before I think any effect could actually make the difference.
Yeah, I think it's similar also to what, well, some other people have said about peak oil and some other things. You really don't know that it's happened until you've sort of passed it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Such a convergence of things and such a wide variety of work being done. We don't know exactly what has which effect and how they interact together and magnify each other or cancel each other out. It's very difficult to know.
And just so, I mean, some people may not be familiar with you, so just sort of talk about some of the different ways that you're trying to get your message out.
Minimum Security is a five-day-a-week comic strip, and I started that in 1998 as a weekly editorial cartoon, and it gradually became a daily comic strip. When I was signed on with United Media's comics.com, it became 5 days a week, and I started doing it in color. And I have regular characters, and it became more narrative. It's about a group of friends who try a bunch of different things to stop ecocide, global ecocide. It used to be about a lot of different topics, whatever made me angry in the news. But now it's really focused on, it's basically a thought experiment going through different scenarios and what works and what doesn't, mostly what doesn't so far, because I don't even know what will. Then Code Green is an editorial cartoon that's once a week, and it focuses on the environmental emergency. And it's more of a classical form cartoon like in a newspaper. In fact, there's a daily paper that does carry it. And I also write a little bit, essays once in a while, and I also do some organizing locally with a group called One Struggle, which is a small collective that's pretty new right now, but it's focused on, it's an anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist group trying to build a movement around that.
One of the things I noticed within Minimum Security is it's gone, since we last spoke, has gone through a change, and the characters are now older. And also what I find interesting is some of your conversations with, especially with Victoria, and I think you even have that as a whole separate conversation on your site as well. I'm wondering if you can just talk about some of the issues that she's bringing up, and I think also there's also debates within the characters about what is effective and what's not, and how they're trying to deal with what can really be effective in the current paradigm.
Well, Victoria, I should explain, is a guinea pig, and she's sort of the stand-in for the strategic genius that I wish that, you know, we had. There are two human characters named Kranti and Javier who, in the story, they try several different things. And one of the things they do is they blow up some construction equipment at a construction site where a nuclear power plant is being built. And the following day, they go and see that everything's going on as before. It made no difference whatsoever. The equipment was just replaced and there was no news about it. And basically, they did it for nothing. So they go to Victoria and say, you know, what do we do? How Kranti has a very strong sense of urgency that if we don't act today and stop this system from destroying the planet, then we're not going to have any more chances later. It's now or never. It's a very urgent situation with climate change, pollution. The system basically will be killing everyone unless we force it to stop. And they're coming up against the reality that there's no mass movement around this. There's not a revolutionary mood among the population. There's little support for any activities that try to stop the system. And so she's feeling pretty desperate, thinking, you know, I've just got to do whatever I can, which in this case was to blow up this construction equipment, and it didn't do anything. So what do I do? And then her friend Javier was sort of against that scheme to begin with, but he just went along because he's her friend and wanted to be loyal. But he believes that there's no shortcut to transforming the system, that you need to build a revolutionary movement and capture the imagination of a large section of the people who could sort of take the reins of historical movement and transform things that way. And Kranti argues, well, that's taking too long. You know, where are they? It would be great, but they're not there. And he says, well, you can't do it without them, so you have to work for that. And they're both coming up against this contradiction that we have, which is that the situation is really urgent, and we don't have the ability to just conjure a revolution out of thin air. So that's what Victoria is talking about. She's saying, you need both. You need to attack the system from all sides and in all ways, and you need the revolutionary movement, and you need it now, and you need to act and destroy the infrastructure of the system also at the same time, but that it's got to be sort of a multifaceted approach. So I supplemented the cartoon. All that was too much to fit into the cartoons, so I supplemented it with text, added that to my blog as like a couple of pages of conversation that they had in addition to what was in the cartoon.
I really like that whole part and that discussion, because I think it's a lot of discussion that a lot of people are having right now. They're trying to figure out what the heck to do.
That I hear all the time from most everyone I talk to is, what do? We understand the problem, but what do we do? And I don't know. It's a very thorny problem, because I agree with the frustrations of all those characters. I mean, they're sort of speaking for the different sides that I see. You know, there's something missing in the situation that I don't know what to do about it.
Now, you also wrote an Fight Our Common Enemy, Global Industrial Capitalism, and I'm just going to quote one of the last statements.
If we are to survive, we must develop ways to work together to combat global capitalism and its crimes, and ultimately bring it down. Individually, we are weak and ineffective. Together, we can be strong. We must build a movement that embraces our political and ideological diversity and our independent autonomy, while creating a mechanism for common and complementary action. The struggles to end all forms of domination, oppression, and ecocide are intertwined. If we can unite our energies, we will increase our chances for success.
So, can you talk about more why you feel this is necessary?
Sure. I think that the main problem in our society is the private accumulation of profit and exploiting human beings and their labor, and extracting natural so-called resources. I mean, they're referred to as resources by those who see nature as utilitarian rather than inherently itself. But anyway, that the combination of the exploitation of labor and the extraction of resources and the converting of the natural world into commodities is the main reason that our world is being killed. And there's a small minority of entities that's responsible for this, and they're corporations ruled by, you know, a very small minority of people, and they have collectively built a system that has a stranglehold over every aspect of our society, from education to how we eat, how we function every day, our work, our relationships, everything. And it's the drive, the competition among these entities, these corporations, drives them to continuously expand in order to increase their rate of profit. And they have to do this. It's sort of a mechanism that exists independent of anyone's will. It's, that's how the economy is structured. And in order to stop the murder of the planet and the oppression and domination of whole vast numbers of people, the vast majority of people in the world, we have to destroy that system and build a new system that is based on sustainability and without social classes. And the reason I think it's important to unite on that basis rather than what we want afterward is because capitalism is directly against the interests of the majority of people. It's something that millions of people hate or instinctively resist, even if they don't know what it is. So it could include our common enemies. The people who can consider this a common enemy include, you know, anarchists and exploited workers and communists and socialists and indigenous people and a lot of different kinds of people can, you know, unite on the fact that this is their enemy. And I think it's important to build a movement on that basis rather than becoming sectarian and saying, well, I will only work with an anarchist, or I will only work with communists, or I will only work with certain kinds of people who want a certain kind of society afterward. Because I think during the process of struggling for liberation, we can figure out together what kind of society afterward, you know, serves the people and the planet. And if we only work with the people who are interested in stopping the exploitation of human labor, then we're going to end up with a kind of socialism that's still a growth economy that's still going to kill the planet. And if we only work with people who are interested in stopping capitalism because it's killing the planet, then we're going to lose also, because we won't actually be able to uproot the social inequalities that create this kind of profit making in the first place. So it has to be a broad, multifaceted, from all directions kind of movement, I think.
I mean, I really like that whole statement. It brings into the fact, because a lot of times social movements can be, you know, from my point of view anyway, can be overly human-centric, and then we can take it too far the other way, and there's not, we need to really just sort of say that we got to bring the system down first and then work the process out. And I think that's a really good point. You also had some meetings about NGOs, and you've been doing some work around the Gulf spill, I think, as well. So I wonder if you can just talk about the meeting that you had about NGOs and why you had that meeting and what was the result.
Okay. The small group that I'm working with now, One Struggle, decided to put on a program about NGOs. And one of our members made a great presentation about how NGOs, which I should explain for people who don't know, an NGO is a non-governmental organization, which is usually doing some kind of social work or bringing aid or something like that to people in need, not through specific government agencies, but more through nonprofit kind of entities. So the reason that we felt like we needed to discuss NGOs and their effect on the movement was because right after while the Gulf spill was going on, there were a bunch of people here, I'm in South Florida, who wanted to do something about it, you know, wanted to somehow make it stop. We didn't know how, we didn't know what we wanted to do exactly, but we called a meeting and about 50 people showed up, and it was really a good discussion, and it encompassed a range of people from very liberal or very new people. Some people had never taken political action of any kind before, and then it also had, you know, a range through very radical people who had been activists for years or felt had made this their life work. So the first meeting, we broke up into different committees, and it seemed like every point of view was able to be encompassed in the different activities that we were starting to coalesce around and start to decide to do. But some of the more radical people felt that it was being dominated by more of a reformist approach, an approach that was sort of asking politicians to make changes or demand better laws or have petitions or protests at politicians' offices. And there were others who thought that the politicians are actually part of the problem, and they are representing a system that puts corporate needs over any other needs, so that they can't be appealed to. And gradually, when the radical people didn't come for whatever reason, some couldn't make some of the meetings and some left, the coalition ended up being pretty much only representing the more liberal views. Right. And the protest that we ended up having was fairly taken over by a couple of NGOs, and they brought their signs, and it ended up turning into a group that their main focus is talking about clean energy, and mm-hmm. any kind of opposition to the system or opposition to or any kind of militancy completely disappeared. Right. It was pretty much ruled out of order. So I talked with a few people who wanted to form a group that was more explicitly anti-capitalist, so that we could, in the future, have coalitions with a broad range of people and not have our voices silenced, but more take part as one of the kinds of forces involved in something like this, and not be sort of drowned out by the spontaneity of wanting to work with these large green organizations and that sort of thing. So we had this meeting, and a lot of people were very interested in it. About 40 people came to the NGO meeting, and the person who made the presentation talked about how NGOs are a way of channeling people's frustration and opposition to the system into safe ways that make them not really a threat, such as basically social work or charity work. And the conclusion that we came to at the meeting, it wasn't really a consensus thing, but it seemed like the prevailing idea ended up being that NGOs can do very good work. There are a lot of NGOs that fulfill very real needs, and it's fine to work with them, but don't confuse that with political work.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, I've run into the same kind of situation here a little bit, and I think you and I talked a little bit about it mm-hmm. over email, but just running into suddenly the needs of NGOs or how NGOs behave dominated a whole conversation that really wasn't the right place for it. From my point of view, we should have dealt with the issues that we were dealing with mm-hmm. and then had separate meetings about, like you did, just about NGOs and how do NGOs relate and how do they do the thing that they're, the way you dealt with it was quite good. It's just sort of have this separate meeting about the importance or the place for NGOs within activist movement. Because I think that often that ends up being co-op activism. And the other thing I also think it tends to do is that a certain elitist, people who are part or paid or belong to NGOs, have certain, to me, I mean, it comes across this way anyway. I'm not going to say that somebody is necessarily being this way, but it comes across this way, that they have a certain attitude that what they're doing is right. And mm-hmm. and it separates, I guess, somewhere, maybe it was in what you had written there as well. It separates the movements from the people in a lot of ways.
I think by being paid, then once you're paid, you kind of have to toe the line. You can't really be swayed by other opinions right. anymore. You have to behave in the way the NGO is paying you to behave. And so where is your action then real? And it can't really be modified. And then also your interest becomes in perpetuating your own activity. So everything you do has to be defined as a success. Like, oh, well, you know, we didn't really stop the oil spill, but we got some senator to vote a certain way. So yay us, and please refund us.
That's an excellent point. And I see that. I mean, when you talk about that, I see that a lot. I mean, to one degree, partly we can understand. I mean, as you said, we're losing. And one of the things we're, you know, often desperately looking for is any sign of victory.
Right. So we'll take whatever we can get and redefine things so that they're victories instead of failures. Yeah. Just keep yourself going.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, it's just, you know, somehow there's got to be something that, because it really is, you know, a daunting process.
It really is. It's huge. It's,
yeah.
There's nothing larger in our scale of life.
When we started setting up this interview, one of the things we talked about is that, and from my point of view anyway, is that you are telling stories. I think you're a pretty good storyteller.
Oh, thanks.
And I think that through either your single Code Green pictures, cartoons, and your weekly, that you are telling stories to that. And we also talked about the need within these stories also of visions of what our expectations are regarding the future and what and how that can translate into political organizing and activity.
I think part of it is coming up with different scenarios so people can imagine themselves in different situations and try to figure out how they would behave, comparing themselves to characters and agreeing with one or disagreeing with another. And I think it helps solidify people's outlooks. And I also think it poses moral questions too. We have villains and heroes in stories. And so we have to take sides when characters do something. Did they do the right thing? Did they do the wrong thing? Did they do it on purpose wrong? Are they evil? Are they good, but they just made a mistake? So I think it's just posing these questions through stories probably, I hope anyway, helps people sort of think through these issues in sort of a rehearsal kind of way. Like, well, what would I do in that situation? And then if they are faced with that situation, they would already know what they would think or how they would behave. They're sort of experiments in narrative that we can take into our own life. And also, I think dealing with fears and uncertainties, that someone might not have any idea what it's like to be at a protest, for example, because they've never done it before. But if they see their characters who they're familiar with being in that situation, it's sort of, I think, helps people understand situations that are unfamiliar.
Recently, you worked on worked to publish a book called Mischief in the Forest. Can you talk about why you thought the book was important? Maybe just a little bit about the book as well?
Sure. Mischief in the Forest is a children's book, and it's a story that Derek Jensen wrote a couple of years ago, I think. And he did it for his mom. And he was looking for an artist, and I drew a picture that I thought would go well in it, and he liked it. And so we decided that I would be the illustrator for it. And the story, the basic moral of the story is, or the message of the story, is that we aren't alone in the world. There are many forms of life who are our neighbors, basically, and we should get to know them. Thus, in the story, there's a woman who lives alone in the forest, and she thinks she lives alone because she doesn't really explore the forest itself or get to know all the different creatures who live there. And finally, you know, by the end of the story, she does. And so I think it's a good message for kids, especially, to sort of expand their circle of who is their neighbor and who could be their friend and their circle of empathy, basically. So that's why I think it's...
I must say, there's not many children's books like that out there right now. It's sort of showing that relationship and that interconnectedness.
I think it is something that kids have to be taught. It doesn't... Like, I had a friend who was around 4 years old, and one of her parents taught her to step on bugs. Mm. And as soon as I said, oh, no, the bug wants to go outside, let's help her go outside and be with her family, then she suddenly, it's like, switched into thinking of the bug as a being who with feelings. And so we helped the bug, and ever since then, she's all about saving bugs.
That's great.
Yeah, so kids are very porous and flexible, and they will follow the models of the adults around them. And so a story like this, I think, helps expand the circle of empathy. These are all creatures who are feeling and thinking beings that we need to take into account.
What stories are activists telling themselves that both help and or hurt the building of a culture of resistance?
I'll start with the ones that hurt, because those are the stories that we're being told every day, and sort of it's being drilled into our heads through every cultural mechanism. The first one I would say is that those who run things are too powerful to oppose. That's a story that's like very deep in this culture that, you know, it's not worth trying because they're too strong. They're too big. Their armies are too powerful. Another one is that the people can't stand up, whether they're not smart enough, not conscious enough, not strong enough, for whatever reason, that people can't take their own destiny into their own hands. I mean, that's a story that we're fed all the time, too, to be powerless, to think of ourselves as pushed around by social forces that we have no control over, instead of being a social force. Related to that is that we're all isolated and that we're not responsible for each other. Another story I would say is, I think one that we're told in the last few decades with increasing intensity is that it's not right to judge other people's opinions, that every opinion is of equal validity. That's sort of the postmodern philosophy that's like come through from the universities starting with like in the late 60s and has really pervaded all of culture now. And if you can't judge anyone's opinion, then there is no right and wrong. And then who's going to take action if there's no right or wrong? Another one that's very damaging is that the system is reformable and it cares what we think, that we live in a democracy, that we can influence our politicians and we can, through the proper channels, make our voices heard. I think that's a myth and it's one that's very widely believed. So those are some of the most damaging ones, I would say. And then the ones that can help build a culture of resistance are basically the opposite of those, that people can figure things out. We are strong in our collective millions, that the future trajectory where things are going now is not acceptable and we can do something about it. And there is a moral and ethical right and wrong, and we can act to ensure that, you know, right prevails over wrong. And that what that is what corresponds to the natural world and reality itself. I mean, we can judge what is right and wrong by what promotes life and what promotes death. What I think is rooted in physical reality, our ethics can be rooted in, and it's this culture that has taken it away from that. Another story we can tell ourselves is that we can learn from the past, that there have been many examples of people fighting back, and these can be our models.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because a friend of mine is actually, he's fascinated by U.S. culture.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, he does a lot of things. And one of the things he finds really true in U.S. culture is that history doesn't matter. Like, at the present time, in the present paradigm, the history doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Like, history not, like one of the greatest insults you can tell somebody is your history. Mm-hmm. Like, you're so yesterday. Go ahead.
I never thought of that, but it's true. It's used as an insult.
Yeah, yeah. And when he brought that up, I thought it was very, very interesting in and of itself, because it's almost a way of stopping that conversation of looking at what's happened in the past and how we can use it, and also understanding where we've come from and understanding and reconciling some of that past as well.
Yeah, that's a great insight. I mean, it's true that people are taught to forget everything that came before and devalue it, and only value what's new and exciting and novel.
Which, of course, helps the corporate paradigm of buy, 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 right?
Exactly.
You know, we're ongoing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good on the number of levels for them.
And I wanted to, a question that sort of popped up, because it's something that I think sort of out there, and it's one of the, it's one of my own difficulties, is that issue between, or that balance between talk and, I'm doing a radio show, right?
Mm-hmm.
But like you, I have no idea if that has any, you know, effect or not. But that difference between talk and action, and how do we define those things?
That's a really good question. And it's something I also hear a lot of people trying to figure out. That,
yeah.
I mean, talk is certainly valuable. We can strengthen each other. We can help each other understand things. We can cheer each other on. I mean, those are very important. At a certain point, we do need to act, but acting without a strategy is useless also.
Right.
You know, they call it movementism or protest mode, where, I mean, I'm sure you've seen this, and I've done it a million times, of just, oh, something terrible has happened, we must go out and protest it. and march around with signs and nobody listens to you and a few cars honk and then you go home. And that has accomplished precisely nothing.
Right.
And so we have to get away from action for action's sake and figure out what actions will actually accomplish something.
Yeah.
And this is the big question. And talk is, I don't see them as opposed, because when you organize people, you have to talk with them. You have to figure out what your political unity is and figure out your strategy together and try to, you know, see what basis on which you can unite your energy. That's what organizing is, really. So,
right.
and building those relationships and those coherent, cohesive units of individuals so that we can magnify our impact. So it's all part of the same impulse and the same trajectory of action. So I don't see them as opposing each other, but at the same time, they are different and we need both. And
right.
we just haven't really, at least I have not figured out what actions will actually work, because it's so random in history. Like, what's actually taken away a system has often been things that nobody expected.
No.
So it could come out of the air. It could come from any direction, and we just have to be prepared. And I think the main thing now is to build consciousness so that when cracks do appear in the system, we can figure out the best ways to, you know, push our advantage in those. But action for action's sake, it's like what's happening in Tunisia. There's, you know, massive protests. They have the the president has fled the country, but because they didn't have what, at least, you know, from far away, I can't really judge their movement, but
right.
it seems that there is not a popular strategy for taking power, that all those people out there protesting didn't really change the regime. I mean, the regime is still there. So,
right. yeah.
So that's really the key thing, is like that transition from how do we get from massive action and a lot of energy being expended to actually taking over a society and being able to change its direction.
Because one of the things that, you know, in my discussions I've also talked about is that most of the, even historically, most of our, quote, resistances or revolutions have been just changing our form of, well, some could argue of capitalism, or changing the form of how the earth is exploited, not really changing the whole process completely.
Right.
Yeah.
Like in the Soviet Union, it was still industrial. It was still a growth economy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, things yeah. were distributed differently. And for a while, the masses were in control for a little while. But
yeah,
but yeah, there was there were a lot of mistakes and a lot of wrong thinking. And they didn't understand the relationship between the exploitation of labor and the extraction of natural resources, I think. And so they didn't really see the need to stop doing that. And I think there was they were caught up in a world situation where there was a lot of external threat that they felt like they had to overcome by rapidly industrializing. And maybe that was true, but in my mind, it would have been better to fail rather than to industrialize like that.
Just as in the last article called Clicktivism is Ruining Leftist Activism.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was quite an interesting little point. And I know that you talk a little bit about it in the movie In Civ. I wonder if you can talk just a little bit about that, how that sort of feeling that, well, I've clicked a button and I've, you know, done that, so therefore it's been taken care of. That sort of quick action, I've done my bit. And now, is that partly because of how NGOs have set things up? Is that partly also, or is that sort of more because of computer-dependent marketing type mindset that we have?
I think it's those, and I think it's also lack of strategy again. If we don't know, if we don't think about where we want to go, what kind of society we need to have, and work back from there to figure out how do we get that, then we're just following our impulses. Oh, I like that. I don't like that. So we click like, and it feels like we did something. And I'm not against clicking like, because I think it does encourage people. You know, it's mm-hmm. sort of an interactive thing where, you know, we can make our opinions known. I think discussions on blogs and Facebook are great. But we can't confuse that with actual real-world activities that will at some point have to be done. I mean, this is a supplement. I think it's part of it. It mm-hmm. is a form of organizing in a way, because you can find people online and get to know them, get to know their ideas. But we also need to talk with people face-to-face and actually build organizations.
What kind of organization do you foresee would be effective?
My traditional kind of organization to work with is more the older sectarian model, where every kind of ideological question has been worked out, and then you sort of stake out these positions and defend them from all the others. And that, I think, has played itself out and isn't really going to fly for our current situation. So I think it really needs to be a very diverse, ideologically and politically diverse movement with different levels of organization. There needs to be a strong mass movement that has a broader basis of unity, and there have to be smaller circles and organizations within that that are more strategically worked out how to actually accomplish a revolution. And these can be fluid and people could move back and forth between them, but there needs to be some kind of, I would say, regional, national, international levels of these organizations so that they have mechanisms to all work together in tandem when that needs to happen. We need local and smaller ones, and we also need a way to work with others in concert when it's appropriate. So I think every level we need diversity, and we need people to take responsibility for creating these and for basically to be empowered with the ideas of these organizations. You know, you can't really have a democratic organization if people don't talk, if they don't assert their own ideas. I mean, you really need that kind of back and forth discussion and, you know, struggle over how to move forward, rather than a few charismatic leaders and everybody else follows them. That's not going to work, because you kind of have the seeds of the future in the present when in organizing. You know, if you have an organization today that's basically one leader with a bunch of followers, then that's the kind of society you're going to end up with if you win. But what we need, I think, really is more at every level. People need to be participating on an equal basis, and we need to help people do that and encourage them to do that.
Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me on. Blank stares that kill faces I know. Watch the soldiers count the dead. Yeah.
That was Static Age with Count the Dead. Taking us out is Dalia Wasfi, followed by Filthy Politicians with Passengers. Remember, folks, the resistance needs you.
We have an obligation to every last victim of this illegal aggression because all of this carnage has been done in our name. Since World War II, 90% of the casualties of war are unarmed civilians, a third of them children. Our victims have done nothing to us. From Palestine to Afghanistan to Iraq to Somalia to wherever our next target may be, their murders are not collateral damage. They are the nature of modern warfare. They don't hate us because of our freedoms. They hate us because every day we are funding and committing crimes against humanity. The so-called war on terror is a cover for our military aggression to gain control of the resources of Western Asia. This is sending the poor of this country to kill the poor of those Muslim countries. This is trading blood for oil. This is genocide. And to most of the world, we are the terrorists. In these times, remaining silent on our responsibility to the world and its future is criminal. And in light of our complicity in the supreme crimes against humanity in Iraq and Afghanistan and ongoing violations of the UN Charter and international law, how dare any American criticize the actions of legitimate resistance to illegal occupation? Our so-called enemies in Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, our other colonies around the world, and our inner cities here at home are struggling against the oppressive hand of empire, demanding respect for their humanity. They are labeled insurgents or terrorists for resisting rape and pillage by the white establishment, but they are our brothers and sisters in the struggle for justice. The civilians at the other end of our weapons don't have a choice, but American soldiers have choices. And while there may have been some doubt 5 years ago, today we know the truth. Our soldiers don't sacrifice for duty, honor, country. They sacrifice for Kellogg, Brown, and Root. They don't fight for America, they fight for their lives and their buddies beside them because we put them in a war zone. They're not defending our freedoms. They're laying the foundation for 14 permanent military bases to defend the freedoms of ExxonMobil and British Petroleum. They're not establishing democracy. They're establishing the basis for an economic occupation to continue after the military occupation has ended. Iraqi society today, thanks to American help, is defined by house raids, death squads, checkpoints, detentions, curfews, blood in the streets, and constant violence. We must dare to speak out in support of the Iraqi people who resist and endure the horrific existence we brought upon them through our bloodthirsty imperial crusade. We must dare to speak out in support of those American war resistors, the real military heroes who uphold their oath to defend against all enemies, foreign and domestic, including those terrorist cells in Washington, D.C., more commonly known as the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. Frederick Douglass said, "Those who profess to favor freedom and yet depreciate agitation are people who want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the roar of its many waters. The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. Every one of us must keep demanding, keep fighting, keep thundering, keep plowing, keep speaking, keep struggling until justice is served. No justice, no peace."
We're just passengers with life passing by. We accept the world and we don't ask why. We're not driving, but we keep riding, 'cause we can't imagine what's outside it. You'd have to see it to believe it. When you take that first breath, feel free to take a rest, 'cause you need it. When you see it, you believe it. Take that breath and you breathe it, and the best leaving that mess they said you needed behind. Free your mind and let yourself shine. Well, let me tell you, we're all immersed in something that's so cursed. And the worst part of a brand new start is to find your heart, you gotta break it first.
But it's all uphill from here. The fog will lift, that mist still clear. Won't say that the pain goes away, but now you can put it in the right place. Cause it's not just life, it's how we live it. That's the problem, not existence itself. So-called wealth on that magazine shelf is a war on your mental health. Do we really benefit working our lives away? Spending everything we get looking for that new way to space out, disconnect from the stress we put up with for that paycheck. Fuck neighbors, we got Netflix. Fuck nature, might as well forget it. Wait, fuck that, let's think for a minute. You only get one life, start living in it. We're just passengers with life passing by. We accept the world and we don't ask why. We're not driving, but we keep riding. Cause we can't imagine what's outside it. You'd have to see it to believe it. When you take that first breath, feel free to take a rest. Cause you need it. When you see it, you believe it. Take that breath and you breathe it. And the best is leaving that mess they said you needed behind. Free your mind, shine. More children get depressed every day because the brain's a mess. If it keeps up this way, it'll never end though. And the best friends in Nintendo, now they're getting turned into consumers at faster rates than me and you were. It's an onslaught, how can we not see it? Probably cause our iPhones don't tweet it. Now a BlackBerry ain't a fruit. If your Apple freezes, just reboot. And let's not forget where it all gets made by a 14-year-old far away. We are getting too good at selecting what we need to ignore and never question. Everything's spiraling the wrong direction. Try the truth, you'll find it refreshing. Cause deep down you know with those quiet moments, when you hear that voice that's still your own, it's too much to take all at once. We'll help you crawl, then watch you run. We're just passengers with life passing by. We accept the world and we don't ask why. We're not driving, but we keep riding. Cause we can't imagine what's outside it. You'd have to see it to believe it. When you take that first breath, feel free to take a rest. Cause you need it. When you see it, you believe it. Take that breath and you breathe it. And the best is leaving that mess they said you needed behind. Free your mind, these days it takes a lot of work to fit in. Makeup, muscles, college education, they reinvent the Joneses day in, day out to keep us chasing that good life. It's an illusion, it gets lonely when it gets highfalutin. If you don't have enough to buy your happiness right now, then come figure this out, it's a spiritual problem. We take the third world and we rob them just to experiment with our proven problems and ignore the outcomes. Move with the mob cause we're all so scared of being ourselves. Cause we've been told that natural smells, natural faces, natural hair and natural bodies are embarrassing. But fuck that, we could all make a pact to support each other and say I got your back. You can be whoever you are and play your part, as long as love is in your heart. We're just passengers with life passing by. We accept the world and we don't ask why. We're not driving, but we keep riding. Cause we can't imagine what's outside it. You'd have to see it to believe it. When you take that first breath, feel free to take a rest. Cause you need it. When you see it, you believe it. Take that breath and you breathe it. And the best is leaving that mess they said you needed behind. Free your mind and let yourself shine.